Tonight's presentation deals with the blending of attitude, behavior, and knowledge so that indeed one begins to see some immediate results. I think the board out there talked about getting it all together or being congruent. A quick review from the first in the series. One of the things that I asked people who attended, what do you really believe? What do you believe to be true about life? Family, work, environment, justice, and peace. And out of that reflective line of questioning, it was hoped that one could develop a personal philosophy. It's very, very difficult to really achieve anything if you don't have some sort of personal philosophy. What has happened in the past with many folks is they'll go along and buy into a philosophy, buy into some set of beliefs, which may indeed be good. I imagine many of us have done that. And after they've gone as far as they can go, or they seem to be well on the way in light of what they think they believe in, they're always searching for the question, if life is a bowl of cherries, how come I'm always in the pits? So the real key, I suppose, to strategic planning for personal success, for personal effectiveness in the context of the Gospels, and of course it is in the context of the Gospel because we claim to be Christians, should start off with what do I really believe in? And that's what we addressed that first session. Be mindful of the fact that there are two sets of values and two sets of beliefs. One set of values and belief are extrinsic, that which comes outside of ourself, in which we buy into and follow the rules. As time goes by, invariably one will question the rules. Sometimes they're questioned at very early age, early adulthood, teenagers, maybe mature at a time when one should be very mature and really into doing what they're supposed to do, they hit a crisis and they'll question. But nevertheless, if you're growing, if you are alive, you will eventually question the rules, no matter how good they are, no matter how absolutely important they may seem. And the questioning is good, because that's the beginning of transferring an extrinsic control to an internal locus of control. I remember one of the rules that I had to follow, if I didn't, it was under the pain of death. You did go to Mass every Sunday, under pain of death and mortal sin. If you missed Mass on Sunday and died on the way to the movie, you'd go straight to hell. That's it. No reprieve, no nothing. And I remember that's what I had to do. And my grandmother was very, very crafty. She'd say, "What was the Gospel about today?" I never caught on to get a book and read the Gospel ahead of time, but I never did that. And I went to the 9 o'clock Mass, and she always went to the early Mass. She went to the 7 o'clock Mass, so she knew what it was about. And I had better get it right. Well, after I left home, and I was in the military, for 4 weeks, and after the fourth week, they let us go to church on our own. They didn't march us to church. And so that first day, that first Sunday, that nobody marched me to church, I didn't have to go, and I figured nobody would know, I slept in. And I felt so guilty, and I was running around looking for a confessional all week. But after a while, I got to be pretty good, and I just didn't go. I mean, you know, you went sometime, but I just felt awful. And then finally, slowly but surely, as time went by, after about a year or two, I decided, you know, this really doesn't feel so hot. So what happened was I questioned, I refused, I rebelled, and after about a year of that nonsense, I began to change that external locus of control into an internal locus of control. And now I go because I want to, not because you got it. It is amazing how many grown-ups, well beyond their teen years and young adult years, are still going but they're going and doing whatever they do and whatever, wherever it is they go, because of some external locus of control. You follow what I'm saying here? Mm-hmm. So that's why we ask the question, what do you really believe? Never mind what it says in LBW, never mind what it says in the catechism, never mind what it says in the gospel. I'm serious, that sounds like sacrilege. Never mind what it says there, what do you really believe? And then once you begin to find out, for instance, I can't talk about you, but I found a lot of stuff that I didn't believe because I didn't know anything about it. I just did it. And I went to the right sources, the gospel, Hebrew scriptures, some reading, go to school, you learn some things, but slowly but surely what indeed was out there pulling your string, you learn to integrate and you develop your own philosophy about life, about work, about family, about the environment, about justice, and about peace. I'm reminded of a story about the woman who was home preparing dinner one morning, and her husband did not have to go to work. So he was home sitting at the kitchen table drinking coffee and just enjoying himself. He was off that day. And the wife went, she had taken a ham out overnight and let it thaw out, and she had it on the chopping block, and she said, oh boy, we're going to have baked ham tonight, honey. She says, yeah, we're going to have baked ham tonight. And she takes out a great big huge knife and she chops off the end, the butt end, about that much, and pitches it into the garbage. He says, what did you do? She says, now look, you're normally at work, don't interfere in my kitchen. If you like what I'm doing, take your coffee and go out in the yard or go in the garage, do something. But you just threw away a quarter of a pound of meat there. I mean, what are you doing? She says, I've always done that. You never complain, but I'm never here to see that happen. So, he says, but why do you do that? She says, well, we've always done it. Mom does it that way. So as it worked out, his mother-in-law indeed lived in the same town. He dialed her up and he said, Doris, yeah, this is your son. Yeah, fine, things are great. Yeah, I gotta ask you a question. Mary just threw out the butt end of a ham that she cut off and she put it in the garbage. She says, it's always been that way. And Doris says, well, of course. We've always done it that way. That's the way I taught her. Well, where did you get that idea? Well, my mother told me how to do that. Well, it just so happened that Doris's mother was alive in Ohio. 8 miles long distance. And he says, Elizabeth, yeah, this is Doris's son-in-law. I'm fine. Yes, I said I'm fine. Okay. Listen, I got a question. Yes, I have a question. Yes. About ham. You know, baked ham. Well, Mary chops off the end and threw it in the garbage. And I talked to my mom, my mother-in-law, and she said she chopped off the end and threw it in the garbage. And she says, they've always done it that way, and that's what you taught them. And Doris says, oh, shucks, son, we did that because we didn't have a pot big enough. And the kids saw her do that, but of course she never threw it in the garbage. She made stock out of the butt. But you see how the external locus of control drives you down the street, and you don't know what's going on. So, what do you really believe in, and why do you do the things that you do? Our next session took us to a mission. If that's what you believe in, and that's where you are, you had no control and no say-so over being born, but now that you're here, why do you exist? What's your purpose for living? It's a question we asked the people in the following session. And so, one has to deal with that. Once that's out, we now have what we call the where or the what you're all about. Perhaps a better way to put it, this is the what you're all about. What you believe to be true and what you think your purpose for existence is. So that's the what of your life. And then we moved on to talking about goals and where did you want to be. And we said that you could not do a goal. Goals are impossible to do. I know that by definition, one may think they can do a goal, but you really cannot do a goal, because a goal is where you end up. And if you're there, then you can't do it. You're there already. So goals represent where you want to be at the end of some activity and some planning. In order to do a goal, there needs to be objectives. And objectives, we said, were measurable pieces of human activity with a beginning and an end, and that they were measurable. And once several objectives in support of the goals were completed, you will have arrived at where you want to be. And we talked about effective communication as one of the major, major strands in the human activity. We have to be very effective in our communication. We also said that effectiveness and efficiency were two different things, that they were not the same thing. We said that efficiency is making sure that we do things right. That's efficiency. Effectiveness is doing the right thing. And there is a big difference between that. So this brings us to tonight. And to put all this together, it seems to me that we need to examine knowledge, we need to examine behavior, and we need to examine attitude as the three major points which our life evolves. If you can work on that, if you can begin to put a finger on that, if you can bring knowledge and behavior and attitude together so that they are congruent, so that they all measure and are at the same level, then we're on our way, I think, to achieving where we want to be and becoming very, very effective in our lives, particularly in the context of the gospel. What is presupposed here is that we're working our life out in the context of the gospel, that radical document which has been written and proclaimed by four different writers. So I'm going to try something here. We have knowledge. And knowledge of what? Well, knowledge of what I am, where I want to be, and for many of us, we are still in process, so we're on the way. Life is truly a journey. And how I'm going to do it. If you have knowledge of that, if you know about those things, you know how to do that, then you have the first component in this business of becoming full, becoming effective, becoming pretty much a person who has brought their life together. None of this provides any guarantee that there will not be stumbling blocks, there will not be hardships, that there will not be sorrow, that there will not be disappointments. But if you know these things, then you can surmount all those stumbling blocks. I often tell parents when I'm counseling or working with parents or working with families that knowledge in no way guarantees that one will do. Knowledge is not a guarantee of correct behavior. I often reflect on the times when I'm in a supermarket or in a mall. I remember one time, particularly one time in Safeway, I was so embarrassed for the mother. The kid was out there, he was in the basket, and the mom was pushing the kid down the aisle in the basket, and he reached over because he saw a display of whole cereal, I think it's Fruit Loops or something, but the way they had this thing set up, I guess they had this big display, and they had these Fruit Loops like in a pyramid, and this kid grabs the bottom one, and you know what happened, the whole thing. And so the mother says to the child in the basket, "Why did you do that? You know better than that." Well, that was the wrong question, because of course the kid knew better. The kid knew that would fall down. It wasn't a little baby. It was a pretty big kid. I would say about 7, 8 years old, and he just wanted to ride around the basket, didn't want to push. So mom was pushing him around, and his legs were dangling off the side there. And she says, "Why'd you do that? You know better than that." And I wanted to say to her, of course he knew better than that, but that isn't the reason he did it. Knowledge has nothing to do with behavior. Think of all the times you knew that it wasn't good and you did it anyway. You know you don't need that extra 455 calories in that ice cream cone. You know that. But you do it anyhow, you know. I don't need that extra bag of potato chips. Let me tell you, there's a brand of potato chips up in the Seattle-Tacoma area. called Tim's, Cascade Potato. God, now you talk about addiction. I got a chemical addiction problem. I mean, all that grease and fat, it's just, you know, can you just see copious amounts of this plaque building up in my veins and surrounding my heart and shortening my life? I know I shouldn't eat those things. I shouldn't buy them. But I do. Not as much as I could or used to, but I still do. So knowledge is in no way a guarantee of appropriate behavior. So we need to be able to act or do things because we have willed to do them, because we have made a decision to do them, and because we are driven by internal locus of control as opposed to the external locus of control. You hear that, those two phrases used throughout my entire presentation this evening, because locus of control means that which has power over you. That which has power over you. If you want to really get into the behavior thing, consider the two English terms can't and won't. Try it on something that's safe at first, but as time goes by, risk a little bit. If somebody would say to me, I really want you to stop talking now and just kind of leave because we want to go take a walk down before the sun gets too far down. We want to go down to the miners, so down to where they had the mining operation. We want to take some pictures. What would probably be acceptable for me to say is, no, I can't do that. I have a commitment. I'm here with these people. I'm talking. I'm being taped. But that really is inappropriate for me to say. The correct thing for me to say would be, I won't do that. How often do we use the word can't when we should use the word won't? Just give it a thought. I know I do it a lot of time, because if I told you what I really thought, I wouldn't want you to think poorly of me. And if you thought poorly of me and you rejected me, I couldn't stand that. So I want to protect you by not saying that. Who am I really protecting? So think about that. That has to do with taking charge of your own behavior. As time, and like I say, you can't just jump out there tomorrow and you walk up to your spouse and say, I won't do that. Well, take some time and work on something that's safe. I won't confuse you. I'll go ahead and empty the garbage anyway. Start with something that's safe. But when you really think about it, it takes a lot of courage. But this is the basis for internal locus of control of your behavior. Take charge of your own behavior. To wax just a little serious, it wasn't a matter of saying can't when Jesus decided to go ahead with his mission. Some of the scripture scholars tell us that Jesus truly became aware of who he was and what his mission was, and those phrases out of Luke, when he puts the scroll back, gives the scroll back to the person who was attending the scrolls, and he sat down, everybody was looking at him, and he recites that beautiful phrase out of Isaiah, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. Jesus then knew that he had a mission. He was pretty much aware. He'd just come out of the desert, and he'd just come out of this long fast. He had been baptized prior to that in the Jordan, and he was pretty much aware that he had to go. Mark speaks of the suffering servant, and Matthew talks about Jesus knowing what he, you know, we can see that evolve. Jesus took it upon himself to say yes, and he did it. And he knew darn well that he'd end up on a tree hurting for at least 3 hours. He knew that. Because if he could rub the people the wrong way, and he knew that he had to do that, he would eventually end up being killed. And not stoned to death, but hanging on a cross. So the challenge is for us in our day-to-day lives. Nobody is asking us to go out and get crucified, but it can be just as excruciating sometimes to say, I won't. And as time goes by, as you become stronger in your knowledge, your behavior begins to align itself with your knowledge. And one of the best ways, I think, to look at that is begin to practice and exercise the term, I won't, or I will. If you can't, if you physically can't, then use I can't. but most of the time, we can say, I won't. It requires us then to really reflect and think a little bit before we speak. It requires us to be a little introspective about where we want to go. Can we be true to being on the way? So behavior, take charge of my responses, using won't or will not when appropriate, take responsibility for my behavior. In other words, own up to whatever you do. I'm a little nervous about giving this because it sounds so preachy, you know, it sounds like a moral lesson. But hang in there. And then, of course, stay aware of what you're doing. Those of us who are in parish work, in ministry, get in trouble here sometime. And I won't get into a long harangue as to how we get in trouble. I'll just simply say this. Learn to say no. Learn to say no. We sometimes get trapped in what I call a Messiah complex. Believe me, you will not be able to save the world. You will not be able to stop things from changing. People will go on doing what they want to do because you can't make anybody do anything. Jesus couldn't. What makes you think you can? Think about that. The nature of man, I remember a lesson from the Baltimore Catechism, and it's not unlike a response that you will find in the Catechism, in the Lutheran persuasion. A man has a free will. A person has a free will. God did not make any automatons. He did not make any robots. He did not make us slaves. So we always have the option to say no. No for the better or no for the worse. But nevertheless, we are not driven to follow anything. If we're driven to follow anything, it's because we take responsibility for what we want to do, we take charge of our responses, and we use an internal locus of control to say yes. So, those are the two components. We need to line these up. The last one is attitude. Attitude is defined as a general disposition towards persons, places, things, or situations. There are plenty of situations in the world that call for us to examine our attitude. This whole rainbow on the mountain thing is a challenge to us to check out our attitude towards places, South America, South Africa, India, Ethiopia, the United States. There are more people going to bed hungry tonight in the United States than you would ever believe. So you don't have to go too far beyond the borders, right here in our own country. Places, persons, who they are, things. What is my attitude? What is my general disposition toward my possessions? And situations. So that's a definition of attitude. It consists of a constellation of beliefs and values around these places, persons, things, and situations. Hopefully, as we begin to examine what we believe or what we know, what we want, what we're going, what we want to be, and we take charge of our behavior, our attitude will begin to fall in place. If this is not lined up, it is almost certainly attitude. So we can examine any one of these by walking through the other two. Any questions so far? Any thoughts? Gives me a break twice. Okay. If you have no questions, and if you do have questions as time goes by, just jump in and ask. I'll stop. I wanted to share something with you because it's simply amazing what happens when you put these things together. This isn't just a list of things on the board. And it works. It works whether you're talking about sewing, baking, fixing a car, doing the job that you do, that you know well on the job that you work in, doing some sort of craft or some sort of talent that you may have. It works. What you know about it, and the more you practice it, the more you behave or do it, the more you gain in strength, the more your attitude is positive about what you're doing and how to do it. Indeed, it's amazing what happens. There are two other levels that are produced out of putting these three items together, these three dimensions of your life together. If you work on those three dimensions, there are six other things that happen that impact on the people around you, impact on your work, and invariably cause you to become stronger and stronger and more effective. And I would like to demonstrate that to you by actually drawing a diagram on the board. And I would challenge anyone to reflect on that and tell me if it's different. Tell me if it's different. But here's how it works. I've often said one day I'm going to write this down, but I never got around to doing it. Well, not write it down, but to publish it. But I've never done it. Chances are I probably won't until I retire. I don't know if I'll ever do that.
No, you won't do that, Bill.
You're right. I don't know how to say no. Okay, knowledge. And behavior. Spread this out sort of like a triangle. Over here like this. Let's make this attitude. You tie these together like this. Like any triangle, if any one of these breaks down, the thing collapses. But if you work on this, something very, very amazing takes place. When you are able to bring knowledge and behavior together in line, in other words, when they are congruent, when I'm talking the talk and walking the walk is another way of saying it, I become very, very strong, whatever that is. I gain strength. Knowledge tied to behavior together gives one strength. If I know where I'm going, if I know what I'm all about, and I know where I want to go, and I know how to do it, and then I do it, take charge of my life and do it, I become a very, very strong person. Very strong person.
God bless you.
Knowledge and attitude. If I know what I'm about, and I know where I want to be, and I know that I'm in process on the way, and I know how to do that, and I have a positive disposition about person, places, and things around me, situations around me, the stumbling blocks are not nearly as much of an impediment, and I'm able to do some thinking around things, I'm able to bring things in line and achieve. What happens with that, you get insight. Another word for insight would very well be wisdom. Attitude and behavior. How many times have you had to adjust your menu? You're expecting people for dinner. Something goes wrong. They'll never know it because you've rearranged the salad, you've done something. But you have a positive attitude about your ability to cook, your ability to prepare, and you do it. You become very, very innovative. So attitude and behavior give rise to flexibility. Another word you might want to throw in there is spontaneity. You are able to be very much responsive, you're very much able to adapt in the moment. Since you have a good disposition about your surroundings, what's happening, since you have a generally positive disposition about life, work, family, environment, justice, and peace, and about the various things going on. Insight and strength tied together give rise to order. Insight and flexibility or spontaneity gives rise to simplicity. Have you ever seen someone do something and say, gosh, you make it look so easy? because they kind of know what to do. Somebody's working on a car, somebody's working on a piece of material, on a pattern, and the pattern doesn't work out right. And they simply restructure the pattern. Maybe the shoulder or maybe the sleeve isn't right, and they just adjust it. They because they have knowledge of what they're doing, they have a positive attitude about how the results are going to be, they have some insight on how they can make it work, they're flexible enough to make it work, and things look so simple. I mean, they make it look so easy. You can do that. Strength and flexibility, or strength and spontaneity, give rise to growth. At the core of all of this is ongoing creativity and your own spirituality. I said something last 2 days. I want to make sure that we don't get spirituality mixed up with religion. There's a difference. Human spirituality is not the same as religion. I know an awful lot of religious folks, but they're not in touch with their spirituality. I know a lot of folks who have deep, deep spirituality, but they simply haven't made a decision as to what religion they're going to belong to. But they're really saints. They have a deep, deep spirituality. Now, I'm not putting down religion, and I'm not saying you can't have one without the other, but I do want to say, just don't get them mixed up. There's a difference between religion and spirituality. I'd like to use a negative example because the only one I can think of right now. A person may have the disease of alcoholism, and so they cannot afford to drink. A practicing alcoholic drinks, like a lot of people drink who are not practicing alcoholics. So anybody who gets drunk is not necessarily an alcoholic. Alcoholics that they're practicing are drunkards. Not all drunkards are alcoholics. I finally got there, didn't I? That's kind of a negative example. Well, on to use that example, there are a lot of religious folks, but they're not necessarily spiritual. There's a lot of spiritual folks who aren't necessarily religious. What's the difference? Well, there's a lot of difference. Institutional roles, certain protocols, sometimes they all fit. Many religious people are spiritual, and religion lends itself to a form of spirituality, of a wide variety of spiritual practices and personal spiritual positions. But not all spirituality is necessarily religious. Okay. Is that all right with you? Sorry. So, what you have to work on then to bring this into reality is one has to work on attitude, knowledge, and behavior. You can't work on the rest of this stuff. You really cannot. Because once you try to do it, if you don't have this together, you'll never get the inside. So the name of the game is to work on attitude, work on knowledge, and work on behavior, whether it's knowledge of self or knowledge of whatever it is you're going to do. If it's something as mundane and mechanical as fixing something in the kitchen or repairing a leaky faucet, you don't have the knowledge, your behavior isn't lined up with it, it isn't going to work. But the more and more you do it, the more strongly you come in that area. A person who is very, very good at one particular sport, the more they learn about the sport, the more they practice and do the sport, they become a very powerful sports person in that particular area. Attitude and knowledge give rise and insight about that particular activity, and they become flexible. You need only to watch basketball or football or baseball players or people in the local area. As they become more and more knowledgeable and they practice and become positive about what they do, they become flexible, they become insightful, and they become powerful in that. So we work on this. This is for you and for me to work on. What happens is we ourselves, we put out wisdom and insight. People experience that from us. That's what people experience from us. And our lives become orderly. Things become much more simple. And not simplistic, but simple. And we will grow. As a result of that, our internal core, our internal locus becomes even more and more creative. We become more and more in touch with our own spirituality. And we can line up our own spirituality with what we believe to be true about the Gospels, about life, then we seem like it seems as though we might be on the right place, and it seems as though we should be accomplishing this personal strategic planning in light of the Gospels. So now I open it up for questions and discussions or comments or challenges. Yes?
Are you going to teach this stuff in the fall over at Forest House?
No. I am not. Maybe, but I don't know. That isn't planned.
It's too simple. There's got to be something wrong with it.
It is simple. That's what makes it hard. You know, really, it is simple. I wish that I could practice this myself every day 100%. But I have to consistently go back and listen to my own lectures. As simple as that is, it is not easy to do. It's not easy to do. But you just keep working at it. You keep practicing. Keep practicing. Now, we could spend a lot of time. This stuff is the stuff that puts a whole semester of work together surrounding this kind of thing. And I have done that. And Corey asked me, am I going to be doing this back back in my back home situation in my ministry? And we probably will do something like this, but not exactly like this. This is adapted for this gathering here at Holden Village. But it really and truly calls for some real introspection. For instance, attitude. What is my attitude about the plight of the world today? A good question about attitude is, do I really believe that this is a global village? We need only to take a look at current events. Europe is going to become a United States of Europe. It may not be called that, but the common market is no longer a dream, it's a reality. And more we see it happening. The unification of Germany and other types of ramifications as a result of that is going to make the people much more congruent and cooperative working together. With the advent of communications technology 20 years ago, it is nothing now to pick up a phone and talk to a relative in Stuttgart, a friend in Tokyo, or a business partner in Madrid. That's not far-fetched, and there's not a whole lot of super big bucks to do that. The more and more we gain in technology, the more and more we have these things available to us as consumers. We are a global village, but on the other hand, there's a lot of folks out there who are hungry, homeless. You know, what is my attitude about this? Do I still feel like I'm in my own little town and isolated in that? Or is my attitude expanding to really and truly conform itself to the real global village that we are? Something to think about. Yes.
Attitude could be also founded to some degree on false knowledge too, couldn't it? I mean,
yes.
Thinking on the world scale, we could
yes.
be getting the wrong message from some people.
Yes. That's an excellent insight, because that's why the first question is, what do I really believe? And I have to question, well, where did it come from? Why do I believe what I believe? And there are some really hard issues that time doesn't permit us to get into now. I only want to try to give you the format, but think about it. There are things that you and I both may believe in, and you know what? They may not be true. We always thought they were, but they just simply aren't true. And the egg on the face kind of thing is I never really questioned the source. And now, if I really looked it up, I would find that I've been operating off of a false set of knowledge, a false set of premises all my years.
That might have been a politician.
Could be.
But then, like, where do you get the correct information?
The correct information might be, at least it's worked for me, I can't tell you, but there's a lot of course, resource material and data. But the correct information might be is that if I believe I am a Christian, what does the gospel have to say about it? You know, I wouldn't have given you that answer 2 years ago. Because I'm not necessarily a Bible-thumping, scripture-quoting person. That's not my tradition. I can turn you on to a person's room, and she's got you, boy. I don't care what you say. She's got you. She'll tell you from Psalms right on down the line. I don't have that kind of, I didn't get into scripture memory verses. But when you search the Gospels, you need only take a look at the Beatitudes. Take a look at the parables. And so what I did for me, for instance, if I believe that I come from God, and this is a doctrinal thing, this is outside of business and commerce and all the money-making stuff, but I believe that I come from God. I also believe that you come from God. Now, that's beautiful. Isn't that beautiful? That's lip service. So what does that make you and me? That makes us related somehow because we got the same father. Now, if I go around not liking you, because I don't know anything about you, but I don't like you. Well, I gotta get something's wrong with my thinking here. I mean, I go to church on Sunday and I worship the same God she does, and we're both praying for the same thing, but I don't like her. And then John tells us God is love. Now something's wrong here somewhere. So that's how I dealt with it. That's how I got into it. The gospel message is the most radical thing that you will ever read. If you think the Communist Manifesto was radical and far out, if you think some of these other manifestos that are floating around is radical, nothing in the history of humankind has ever beat the radicalism of the gospel. It'll get you crucified. What it'll do. It'll get you crucified. Yes?
Is this similar to what the church is on now with faith maturity, such as with adult, with education?
Yes.
Faith maturity,
yes.
Is this.
I might
get, as we grow, we...
You bet. Yes. Let me give you some references. I'm glad you brought that up because that did not come to my mind to give that reference. She mentioned, isn't this something about faith maturity, or does this relate in some way? You might want to get a hold of a book by Fowler, F-O-W-L-E-R, and it's called Life Maps. He cuts through that whole thing on faith maturity, and he does it in a fairly esoteric way, but it's not such bad, hard reading that you can't get a hold of it. It's really, really good stuff. You may also want to read some of the stuff that, I think some of the stuff that deals with the development of a moral consciousness helps also. How much time do we have? We don't have much time. There are six major levels of moral consciousness. And what happens is we start out, just very, very briefly, at the first level, we're operating at the avoidance of pain, pain avoidance. I'll just paraphrase and use a lot of real quick stuff later on. I'll spend some time if you want to talk about it later on. But as pain avoidance is the reason for my behavior. The next level, the next stage I get into is what's in it for me. That's the next level of my behavior. The reason why I act and behave, and the reason for my thinking and behaviors, because what's in it for me? The next step is meeting the expectation of others so that I can be accepted. I'll do anything so that I can be accepted. It's tied to Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the need to belong, but it stands alone as a reason for working and doing what we do. And it's the third level. For teenagers, it's peer pressure. For us, it's keeping up with the Joneses. But we do anything to belong. The next level is we act and behave to meet the institutional norm. Normally, we would expect this from our judges, our congresspeople, our people in charge of systems, mayors, governors. That's what we would like to think. We need only to read the headlines over the past 6 years, and that isn't working, is it? Watergate was probably the biggest scandal. The institutional norm was not met there. The next level is doing it out of commitment. The next level really has to do operating for the common good. My behavior is based on the good of the whole rather than my own individual good and well-being. And then the last one is what we call the universal ethical norm. few people have ever reached that in the history of humankind. Socrates, Jesus, Gandhi, some have said Martin Luther King, Sister Teresa. These people are operating on a level that's far beyond what we can handle. Even their thinking sometimes doesn't match ours because we simply aren't there yet. And you must go through level one before you can get to level three. Recent studies have suggested that in America, can't speak for the whole of Western civilization, but in America, few adults get beyond level three, meeting the expectations of others. Some make it to level four. We like to think that the Supreme Court and some other high officials are at level four, and occasionally we kind of dip into level four, but for the most part, we're just doing it because we want to meet the expectation of others. We have this great need to be okay, to meet the status quo. You step out of line, you're either weird, you're a hippie, you're a freak, or you're a communist, or you're strange, or something. That's what they did to Jesus. He really got out there. They couldn't stand it. They had to do something to him. They had to get rid of this man. So, yes, this whole faith development thing is found also in those roots. Kohlberg is the name of the man who postulated this thing I just ran off to you in sort of a popularized fashion, and you'll find the work of Kohlberg in several writings. I imagine the Towards a Philosophy of Moral Consciousness is probably one of the better books, and with a lot of detailed information. You'll find it in any library. Lawrence Kohlberg, and he is the person who did the development of moral consciousness. It has nothing to do with religion, nothing to do with the commandments. And he tried this cross-culturally. The Eskimo, the young teenager in Samoa, the young teenager in Nairobi, the young adult in Chicago, somebody in New York. He tested us completely around the world, and the results were the same. We all passed through these.
Passing through these stages,
say, yes, there's been some work done by theologians in that area, and they suggest that for the most part, the apostles were operating out of close to level five. If you want to read something where people were truly committed to the commonwealth of all, the first 13 chapters of the Acts of the Apostles will show you level five operation. People were selling their goods. They were coming together. We know what happened to the ones who held out and lied about it. Well, it looks like we're about there, doesn't it? I have certainly enjoyed your presence. I hope that this has given you something to think about. There are no answers here, but something to think about. Those references, once again, Lawrence Kohlberg, The Development of Moral Consciousness. You'll find his writings in a book by him, Towards a Philosophy of Moral Consciousness. You'll find Life Maps, very, very interesting reading by Fowler, Fowler, a little thin book, but it's excellent. Studies of Piaget would tell you how that works too. You'll find that in the human development section of the library. And of course, don't forget the gospel according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Thank you for your presence.